Good morning. Today, two conference wrap-ups. One on how to work with people engaged in potentially harmful behaviors. We'll talk with Columbia University Professor Carl Hart, the keynote speaker at the Hawaii Harm Reduction Conference. And later in the hour, the changing educational landscape bringing innovation to classrooms. Daryl Galera, the chairman of the governor's team to implement the Every Student Succeeds Act, has the key takeaways from the Hawaii School Empowerment Conference. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Ninja Monkeys are specialists at making knockdown, drag-out fights look real on the movie screen, and a one-act play on Maui looks at the early life of a man who changed history.
It's Monday, January 16th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We'll be back with more conversation right after this news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation on this Martin Luther King Day. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We live in a world where there are any number of threats to our physical safety, well-being, yeah?
We do, and how we go about mitigating those or even changing our attitudes about how we mitigate those is part of what was discussed last Friday as we were going into the weekend. Now, the term harm reduction may seem self-explanatory, but for those who work in the field, the philosophies and strategies have an explicit meaning: to reduce the potential dangers and health risks associated with potentially harmful behaviors. And there are a lot of those, from drug abuse to immigration to Native Hawaiian interventions, and you can fill in the blanks for many more. Columbia Professor Carl Hart was the keynote speaker at last Friday's Harm Reduction Conference. He joins us now. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You travel all over the world to be able to talk about all kinds of policies that have to do with mitigating the harm that people can potentially do to themselves. In Hawaii, we talk a lot about meth. We've talked a lot about marijuana. As you look at Hawaii through the lens of your worldwide travels, how do you view us?
Well, you have to understand that I am a scientist first, and so what I do is I study the effects of drugs like methamphetamine, as well as cannabis, as well as crack cocaine, as part of my research. We actually give these drugs, and we give these drugs to try to understand treatment better, and we try to understand under what conditions we can expect positive effects and under what conditions we can expect negative effects to help keep people safe. And so as I think about Hawaii, the issues are in terms of drugs. The major issues are methamphetamine and cannabis. And so if we think about methamphetamine, one of the things that happens is that we have exaggerated the harmful effects associated with methamphetamine. That's not to say that the drug is not potentially dangerous. It certainly can be. But we blame some of the issues of poverty and all of these things on methamphetamine, as opposed to being able to focus on these other issues. So when we start to blame those other issues, then we're not really helping to solve our problems, and we also are inefficient and ineffective.
It sounds as if what you're also saying is that we not only blame that particular issue, it's methamphetamine, for example, but we look at only focusing on that as the panacea to mitigate the problem.
Yes, exactly. And we waste a lot of money doing that sort of thing as well. And we don't keep our societies any safer. And so if we look beyond the drug itself, we might actually try to figure out what the problems are.
So what do you see when you look beyond the drug?
When I think about any drugs, we think about methamphetamine. It's important for y'all and the audience to know that methamphetamine has been and is used currently by a number of militaries around the world. So that means that the drug can be used to keep soldiers awake, more alert, fight better, and so forth. And the drug is also FDA approved to treat attention deficit disorder and also obesity. So it's important for people to understand that the drug has potential positive effects and beneficial effects. And so the drug is not uniquely dangerous. And if you know that, now you can start to say, well, what about these people who are having problems? Because there are people who use methamphetamine and they have problems. It tells you that, well, we have to look beyond the drug because other people, like militaries and so forth, are using the drugs safely. So what is it about those people who are having problems? If we can figure that out, then we could actually maybe help solve their problems and keep our society safer.
That seems to be the same approach to looking at just about any drug that could be easily abused, any prescription drug.
That's exactly right. Or even alcohol. For example, alcohol has potential beneficial effects. It relieves anxiety. It's a social lubricant. But we know that there are people who have problems. There are some people who overdo it. And so we have to ask questions like, well, what is it about those people? What's going on under these conditions that increase the likelihood of people having problems?
At the conference on Friday, you talked a lot about addiction as a brain disease and how that moves into social injustice.
Yeah.
What's that connection?
Yeah. So today we think about addiction as a brain disease, but there is almost no evidence of that. And so we have all of this attention focused on if you think about addiction as a brain disease, it leaves you with one or two approaches. Then you want to make sure that you fix the brains of those people who use the drugs. That's number one. Or number two, you want to remove the drug from society, and that way you don't have the drug interacting with people's brain. But it doesn't leave any room to think about the social environment under which those people are living or people who are having problems. And so the notion that drug addiction is a brain disease, first of all, is not supported by any evidence, certainly not evidence in humans, but we tend to believe that. And a lot of the funding, is particularly research funding, goes into this model. And when the research funding is going into that model, it's not looking at social factors that are involved. And so since we are on this Martin Luther King Day, for example, I think about Martin Luther King opposition to the war in Vietnam, for example. He said that he was opposed to the war in Vietnam because it took away money from poor people, or it took away resources from focusing on the issues of poor people. That's what's happening with this whole notion that addiction is a brain disease.
So can I ask you about some of what we have seen come out that we have been told that as people use certain drugs in certain people, in certain populations, that rewires the brain and that it stops its full growth. If, for example, a child starts to experiment at age 14 or 16, that the brain kind of goes on hiatus for a while until the drug is no longer in the system. How do you respond to that kind of research that we hear a lot about?
No, that's a great question. So when you say rewiring the brain, so that you use these nebulous terms, and that's a nebulous term. I have a PhD in neuroscience. I don't even know what that means.
Why I'm asking you.
No, but you're absolutely right, because we hear it in the public, and that's a great question. But it doesn't mean anything. There's no evidence of that. I mean, one of the things that we hear is, if kids take, by the way, I want to make it clear that we're not advocating that kids use drugs. That's number one. Nobody's advocating that. But one of the things that's said is that you disrupt prefrontal cortex development. The prefrontal cortex, of course, is important for planning and all those things that make
judgment,
us human.
Reason.
Absolutely. And so we say that, well, it disrupts prefrontal cortex development. Now, let's think about this. I have kids who have asthma, and they've been taking these medications for all of their life. And then there are other kids who are taking attention deficit disorder medications like amphetamines. And then you have kids who play sports like American football. All of these things certainly have potentially impact the brain, but we don't say that those things disrupt prefrontal cortex development, because prefrontal cortex development is really difficult to disrupt. Now, this isn't to say that if you are a parent, which I am, you don't want to have 14-year-olds smoking marijuana or drinking alcohol or doing tobacco or any of those sorts of things. You still have to be a parent. But the notion that we're somehow disrupting prefrontal cortex, that's been far overstated.
I can't imagine that this is resonating very well with other researchers who are doing exactly that kind of research. What kind of interaction do you have with them, and how does this either further or not further our real understanding of what happens with drugs in a kid's system?
Well, you have to understand that. So my PhD is in neuroscience, and that's what the kind of research that I was doing. And so when I found out that we had overstated the case, it made me angry because we weren't exactly being honest with the public. And so, and also, it was taking away resources from really trying to get at the real problem. And so the interactions that I have with other researchers are we have great discussions, and the best evidence wins. And that's the lovely thing about science. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're charismatic. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy. Only evidence matters. That's the currency. And so I enjoy those conversations because, like I said, there's virtually no evidence in humans to support this notion that we talk about, this prefrontal cortex development disruption.
I wish we had more time, but we'll hopefully talk to each other in future. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Dr. Carl Hart, for being with us. Professor Carl Hart is the chair of the Department of Psychology. He also teaches in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University. His award-winning most recent book is High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey to Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. He was the keynote speaker at Friday's Harm Reduction Conference.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. didn't live to see 8 years of the first black president.
We feel now connected to our grandfathers in a way that is surprising. We are actually fearful about being black people walking around America.
Some familiar ghosts of racial conflicts in America unresolved. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:18. Coming up, how to choreograph a movie fight scene without getting anybody hurt. But first, your quiz.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had a special connection to Hawaii and was a staunch advocate for Hawaii's statehood. Statehood had been opposed for decades by the Southern Democratic senators known as the Dixiecrats, who had fought integration and the passage of civil rights legislation. He found allies in the newly established 50th state and came here in 1959 to speak at a Hawaii House of Representatives special session. In his address, he said, quote, "As I think of the struggle that we are engaged in the Southland, we look to you for inspiration and as a noble example where you have already accomplished in the area of racial harmony and racial justice, and we are struggling to accomplish in other sections of the country." During his 1959 visit, he befriended a local minister, a friendship that was symbolized by the white flower lei that Dr. King and other civil rights leaders wore in their celebrated 1965 march in Selma, Alabama. For today's backyard quiz, we're hoping you can tell us the name of the local religious leader who sent those lei to Selma for that historic march. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're the first one to get it right, you get the prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Mark Kalahele from Kumukuhua Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Stunt performers are no longer at the sidelines of the movie industry. They're at the center. A quick scan of any of the shows at the multiplex will include people flying all over the place in ways that were unimaginable a generation ago. It's about making the impossible look easy, and that calls for a whole new generation of stunt specialists. Such a one is Grant Miyashiro of the Ninja Monkeys, a Hawaii-based group of specialists in stunt training, fight scene choreography, and stunt coordination. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Grant.
Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
You know, we were talking before the show, and I was saying I saw a bunch of previews at the theater over the weekend, and almost all of them were stunt-driven. That's really a change, isn't it?
Yeah, before it's a lot of comedies and more dramas. Now there's more pull to more action movies, which is good.
What are the influences? What brought all this about?
Well, when in 2004, we did a local – a friend of mine was playing Ninja EX, Mr. Kevin Wan. He was playing Ninja EX on OC-16, mm-hmm. directed by Aaron Yamamoto. And then so from there, we just kind of stayed together and we started training together because we're more friends that did martial arts versus stunt people. So after a while of learning how not to fall, we learned how to fall correctly. Mm-hmm. So then we started teaching other people who wanted to find out, and eventually we grew to the organization that we are right now.
But martial arts is very much a part of contemporary stunt work in movies, right?
Yes, it is.
What are the other things that have changed the way stunts are done in movies?
There's a lot of work with green screen. There's a lot of more, I think, high-impact car stunts, more physical. The stuntman has to be more physical. They are more gymnasts, martial artists, be able to do more flips, more dynamic falls. You know, that kind of a training regimen is really difficult, but, you know, it's something that needs to be done if you want to be a stunt person, be safe.
And all of which requires a great deal of training and being in great physical shape as well.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Specifically, you guys do a lot of work with fight scenes. And,
yes.
And fight scenes these days are very martial arts influenced, yeah?
Yes.
What is it, you know, in terms of the hero taking on eight guys or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how does that evolve over the years?
So I think we're seeing a little bit more of the old Hong Kong style of fight scenes, you know, slowly integrating into, like, American movies, and especially in TV, like they have Into the Badlands with AMC, and then they have Daredevil season one with Netflix and Marvel. And those are, you can see more of the fight scenes evolving that way with the longer takes that they do in Hong Kong.
How would you describe the Hong Kong style?
The Hong Kong style is more like the old school Jackie Chan style movies where they're fighting. They can actually do a longer take because everybody in the scene can actually fight. So you're doing like maybe 30-second or 10-second shots versus in America, like, you know, to take something like Born Identity where the action is chopped up. You know, there's a lot of edits and stuff like that. So,
well, people actually fight, but how do you do that without hurting each other?
A lot of training, a lot of practice. With us, me and the other stunt guys, we've worked together so long in the Ninja Monkeys that when you put us into a fight scene, we know how far the person can reach, how we can react to them, what their timing is. Mm-hmm. So it actually really helps us a lot more when we actually do a production.
So when you have a shot of, say, a punch,
mm-hmm.
Obviously you don't connect.
Right.
But what do you do? Come, you know, within a half inch or...
It's mostly camera angles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do something like over the shoulder, you can actually be about a foot away and still throw the punch. But if you react correctly when the fist comes, it actually looks like a real hit.
So when the fist is at the end of its arc, you fly back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's all depending on the choreography that is on there. Sometimes if you need to be pulled back more, then, you know, rig you up. Pull you away.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends on the choreography.
You mentioned Jackie Chan. Is he really an innovator? in his movie, his Hong Kong Chop Saki movie?
I think so. I mean, Jackie Chan is like my hero. I've looked up to him ever since, you know, I saw his first movie, you know, and, you know, his comedy and the way he performs and just the use of the practical stunts, you know. He broke almost every single bone in his body.
Yeah.
And he has innovated it, you know, not just the stunt work, but how his team works together. And watching how they work with one another is kind of amazing.
You were telling me that they, in a mass fight scene, they have ways of giving each other verbal cues.
Oh, yeah. Jackie Chan, My Sense, is a great DVD documentary on this stuff. So Jackie Chan is in the middle, and they have all these guys around him. But the guys in front do a certain kind of growl, and the guys in the back do a separate kind of growl. So when they fight him, he knows when they're coming.
From behind
and stuff like that. So he knows where to act or what the timing is so that he knows he can duck underneath the punch or move away from the kick or the stick that's coming that way.
This sounds like an awful lot like very intricate dance.
Oh, yeah. Because he's trained in Hong Kong opera.
Chinese opera.
Uh-huh. So a lot of his fight scenes are very almost dance-like. He can actually put a beat to his fight scenes because it's very rhythmic the way he does his fight scenes.
Well, you don't want to emulate him in terms of breaking every bone in your
body.
Right?
No.
So how do you keep it all safe?
We just make – when we choreograph stunts, we want to make sure this – we want to make sure we keep in mind not only the intensity of the fight scene, but the ability of the people in the fight scene.
Mm-hmm.
If the person can't really do a kick, I'm not going to ask them to do, you know, a 360 spinning heel kick. I'll just make, if they're more of a boxer, you know, have them do more boxing stuff.
It really helps that you folks have worked together, I would think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly.
Sort of knowing what you can do and what you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Just like life.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot, Grant.
No problem. Thank you.
Grant Miyashiro is a member of the Ninja Monkeys, a Hawaii-based group of specialists in stunt training, fight scene choreography, and stunt coordination.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
Hi, Ray Cruz here. You know, we're all part of some community, whether it's your neighborhood, your sports team, or your island. You're also a part of HBR's community, a community of over 190,000 listeners who tune in every day for the news and music they depend on. We depend on our entire community, too, and are asking each of you to pitch in and do your part at whatever level you're comfortable with. Become a sustaining member today by going online or giving us a call during business hours. Thanks.
If you're a parent or someone keen on educational movements, you've probably heard the phrase school empowerment for quite a while. How it actually comes about in Hawaii schools could ramp up this legislative session. Governor Ige's budget includes a request for $20 million in funds for a new innovation grants program. And at a focus group this past weekend, teachers were full of ideas about how they'd use the money. The focus group was part of the third annual Hawaii School Empowerment Conference, sponsored by the nonprofit Education Institute of Hawaii. Daryl Galera is the chairman of the governor's team to implement the Every Student Succeeds Act. He's with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming back. At Saturday's conference, first of all, you had the keynote speaker, Tony Wagner, who some people may know from both the film and the book, Most Likely to Succeed. And he so challenged a lot of the assumptions that people have about education and a basic thing that, you know, for a long time we've been talking about, you know, the information age, but he says that's long been over. We're really in the innovation era, and we have to change the way we teach kids to do that. And he gave several examples, including the fact that, you know, firms that are hiring, firms like Google, 15% of their new hires don't even have a BA.
I think everyone at the conference thought that Tony Wagner's speech was one of the most powerful and one of the most inspiring and uplifting keynote speeches that they've ever heard. He provided many, many important pieces of advice for Hawaii to look at. And so we're going to be making it available for everyone to hear his amazing keynote, and we're hoping everyone across the state can watch it.
We should say, too, that Tony Wagner will join us live next Thursday, not this coming Thursday, but next Thursday on Town Square. But the point that he was making is that we're really looking at creating an educational climate where kids truly do get involved with collaborative problem solving, and how they see problems and how they work together to solve them is very different from that very individualistic way that we have been looking at education, what you can do, how you can be, you know, more competitive than another person. And that also seems to thwart what many parents feel about the education of their child, wanting their child to do well.
I think Beth Ann, it was or that thought was shared from the governor in his address and from the board chair in his message, that our future and how we prepare our kids for this innovation-driven future has to be dramatically different from what we're doing now. And the only way our students will be successful in the future is that they will be part of a learning system that promotes innovation, creativity, creative problem-solving at the highest possible ways.
The governor showing up to be able to speak at the conference is one thing, but seeing him there in that focus group where the room was just so packed with educators and other people who were concerned about how we change the very fabric of education to reflect what's going to be necessary in the future. And in many ways, we don't know what that is, except to say how people think is changing and what's required of them is going to be changing. To see him go from table to table to table and spend that time and having teachers say, no, we don't want to give this up. We want to talk some more. Was rather amazing.
That was a first for me, again, to see the leader of our state not only sharing and sharing some innovative ideas about now how we can improve our system, but then really taking the time to listen carefully to what teachers, our principals, our students, our community members are saying. It was pretty uplifting and inspiring, I think. And you're right, it was standing room only. It was quite a sight to see.
If, as Tony Wagner has been saying, that innovation is a team sport and that this should be reflected in how teaching happens so that you have a team of teachers who work collaboratively modeling all of that, how did that go over with teachers and what did they say coming out of that session, since you've been privy to a lot of the evaluations that have come from the conference?
Yeah, it's been quite a buzz, and we've been getting a lot of emails and comments. What people have been sharing in the post-conference feedback and evaluations has been extremely powerful. People obviously are really thirsty, and this is something that they've been waiting for, and I think Hawaii's ready, and we're at a great place, but then this opportunity before us is unprecedented, and I think we're going to see some very special things happen.
How do you see that being reflected in real change and real activity, and not just the rhetoric about change?
Yeah, moving from the vision to reality is the hardest part of the work, and so right now I think we have leaders like our governor and our board that are putting everything together and all the pieces that have to move forward in terms of policy. Now it's going to go to the hard work of the legislators and our lawmakers to try to find the resources and the ways to support all of this. So this is a great time for people across the state to look at these great proposals and to share your support. If you support funding for innovation grants, and so teachers and principals can be more creative and inspire their kids more. You know, let your legislators know this is a great time to do that.
And we should say, if you are looking for some inspiration in that way, the film Most Likely to Succeed, I believe, is going to be shown on PBS on the 16th of next month. But you can certainly find it in other ways before then, or read the book. But looking at this idea that we're trying to change the culture of the classroom from consumption to collaborative buy-in and engagement, some teachers have been trying to do that. And they say, well, you know, what makes this different than a group project? What makes it different?
Well, you know, one of the things that Tony Wagner shared with us was that to challenge us to take a real close look at what we do in terms of our accountability and responsibility systems in our education system. And so we need to be very, very thoughtful about that. And he even threw out the challenge that, you know, we have a mindset now that we have to test every student and we have to spend so much more time and resources doing that. And he said, look at the top systems in the world. And we're doing sampling. We're not testing every student, but we're doing enough so we can get the accurate information so we know how we're doing. And then he says we can save all of the money that we're using on high-stakes testing, and we can put it back into even higher quality testing and assessment in the classrooms where teachers take the lead and schools take the lead. It was kind of a refreshing way to look at it.
Very different from what we heard during the No Child Left Behind era, where all that data was being collected. I was also told that nothing was being done with that data.
It's interesting. I think we have been drowning in data and not necessarily being the best users or analyzers of data. And it's very, very expensive, the approaches that we've been taking. So, you know, this is a great time. We've learned a lot, and I think it's a good time now to take that learning and move forward and do even better for our kids.
As always, I wish we could continue this conversation. We'll have to do that another time. Thank you so much for coming in on the holiday.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Daryl Galera is a former public school teacher and principal who was appointed by Governor Ige to the Board of Education in October. He's the school leadership consultant and coach for the Hawaii Center for Instructional Leadership. He's also currently serving as chairman of the governor's ESSA team.
Island residents and classically trained musicians Nancy Shupwu and Ian O'Sullivan make a perfect pairing. Hear their renditions of classical works and their own Hawaii-inspired originals in the Atherton Studio on January 28th. For reservations, call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, the whole climate around prescription painkillers has gotten to be kind of a mess, hasn't it?
Well, it really has. In the last year, we've even had the Surgeon General put out a report that says that basically people are using too many pain pills. So it's really put a lot of folks in a situation where they're just not quite sure what else to do. They have pain. They don't know how to treat it other than pain medication, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to get quantities of pain medicine indefinitely because now we're finding that that's what's getting people hooked on it, truthfully. So we're going to talk today about what are some of the other alternatives and how can people deal with chronic pain in a way that may not actually include pills.
Well, short-term, anyway, the most effective medications for severe pain are opium-derived, right?
Yeah, pretty much almost all of them are. So, you know, we're going to talk about what are some of those other ways that you can treat pain. And in the last couple of years, they've done a lot of research with things like mindfulness-based stress reduction and a whole bunch of different types of ways that people can learn to help themselves during the day to even tolerate some of the exacerbations of pain and learn how to almost reprogram their brain so that they don't need to reach for pills all the time. So we're going to talk today about what are some of those different programs How successful are they really? And is it something that people should be interested and consider using?
It's kind of a mind over matter approach, right?
Well, we'll talk about it today.
All right. Thanks, Kathy. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Hi, good morning. I'm David Cheever from the Hawaii Architectural Foundation. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies and in the massive universe around our tiny planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we're welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, look out for Venus and Mars in the southwest during sunset, and keep an eye out for Jupiter, which will be rising shortly after midnight in the east. The moon this week will be waning, meaning, of course, a return to dark skies and perfect stargazing conditions by the weekend.
Christopher mentioned Mars, and it turns out we have a locally based preparation for a mission to that planet.
Yes, this week sees the start of another simulated Mars mission on the slopes of Mauna Loa, the latest in the High Seas Project. That is the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation Mission. For the next 8 months, a team of 6 scientists and engineers will live alone on the slopes of the volcano. The goal is to simulate what conditions will be like during a manned mission to the Red Planet. This is actually the 5th such simulated mission so far. The first one kicked off in 2012.
And what sort of activities would constitute their general day?
Well, the team will undertake a variety of activities, including outdoor exploration tasks such as geological fieldwork and life systems management.
And from our previous media coverage of this, they're wearing spacesuits and really trying to simulate what it might be like to be doing this on Mars, huh?
That's exactly right. In order to make this as realistic as possible, the astronauts will plod around in clunky spacesuits. And every time they want to talk to mission control, there will be a 20-minute delay in getting a response, exactly how it would be on Mars.
The one thing that they're not going to have to deal with, I imagine, is the weightlessness or any kind of impact on gravity.
That's right. Martian gravity is actually 1/3 as strong as the Earth, and there's no real way to simulate that.
You got to believe things might get a little testy being in such close quarters with a small group of people.
Yeah, indeed. One of the goals of this mission is to study human behavior and interactions during long-duration spaceflights. Just imagine being stuck in a tiny tin can with 6 other people for 8 months.
Not unlike what's going on in the space station, though.
Absolutely.
These experiments that they do are also trying to find the right personalities for such a mission.
You got it. It takes a special kind of person to be involved in such challenging environments.
Well, we will leave it to those professionals, won't we?
Rather than to me.
It's Christopher Phillips and another great Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. Letter UCareHI.com.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered a famous image from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1965 march in Selma, Alabama. In photographs of that historic march, Dr. King, Coretta Scott King, and others can be seen wearing white flower lei that were sent them from Hawaii. They were worn as a symbol of the marchers' peaceful intentions and harken back to a 1959 visit Dr. King had made to the islands. In a September 17, 1959 speech at the Hawaii House of Representatives, he said, "If democracy is to live, segregation must die. Segregation is a cancer in the body politic, which must be removed before our democratic health can be realized. In a real sense, the shape of the world today does not permit us the luxury of an anemic democracy." During his 1959 visit, King befriended a local spiritual leader, the Reverend Abraham Akaka, pastor of Kauai Hau Church, the man who sent Flower Lay to Selma 6 years later.
And Ellen Stomer called us from Hilo. She knew the answer and will be receiving a prize. Thanks so much for joining us for the Backyard Quiz today. Now, if you've got a question for us, you can send it in. We'll vet it, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
History is filled with stories of men and women with unimpressive beginnings who went on to have a major impact on the world around them. But few have had as dramatic and unlikely a rise to power as the subject of Anthony Pignataro's play, Small Town Lawyer. It's coming to the Maui Fringe Festival, and it's bound to surprise you with the little-known backstory of a man whose name you're bound to know. He's with us by phone. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning.
This is a pretty fascinating story, even to someone who thinks he knows the biography of your subject.
Well, thank you. I thought so, which is why I wrote this, the play. Although I decided to have some fun by keeping the identity of the main character a secret until the very end, to kind of wink at the audience. So the challenge for me then was to write a play, basically just a one act, one scene, short conversation, if you will, about a young attorney who's having a particularly difficult day and having kind of a crisis of confidence, and then have that, you know, have him discuss it with his mentor, the guy who runs the firm, and then try to make that work on its own so that even if somebody, say, misses the big reveal at the end, mm-hmm. the play still works as kind of a straight drama with a lot of comedy thrown in because a lot of funny things happened.
But yeah, it can't just be a play about a loser, right? It's got to be have some. You have to care enough about the guy for one thing.
Well, this is my great goal to get people to kind of think about when we produce stories, movies, especially without ideology. Black Hawk Down is a big one. The Germans did a great one, Das Boot.
Yeah,
where you're basically rooting for Nazis.
Right.
And I think that there's a huge danger when we tell stories without ideology because we end up making heroes out of people who probably ought not to be heroes.
Sure. You could have an aspiring painter with the Iron Cross from World War I who aspires to become Chancellor of Germany and then find out he's not a particularly likable guy, right?
That's exactly the danger. And I think I think Hollywood especially takes out ideology because they don't want to limit their audience. But when you're doing that, you're changing the story in ways that are particularly dangerous. You're making, like I said, you're making people, you're lionizing people who really don't deserve it. So what I did was I just had to have some fun and write a short comedic play about that and enter it into the Maui Fringe Festival.
Well, you know, even somebody you don't particularly like, somebody likes him, right? Everybody's got a mother who loves him at some point, or most people do. And you have to, in order to make a drama work, you have to make him somebody the audience can care about, right?
Well, that's exactly the case, which is why the play needed to work on its own merits without the big reveal at the end. I got lucky in that I was able to get some of the best actors on Maui. Kevin Hazelton is a very good local actor. He's playing the young lawyer. Vinny Linares is a wonderful, wonderful actor. Is playing his mentor, and Felicia Chernicki Wolf is playing kind of the client at the beginning, who's seeking a divorce and is kind of not so much problematic, but just somebody that the young attorney was not prepared for.
But
and
he's
that kind of sets up the stage for what follows.
So basically the action under discussion, he's talking with his mentor, is that the conversation?
It opens with him with the young lawyer talking to this client. She wants a divorce. And things kind of go haywire in a funny way. And then he kind of has a crisis of confidence, and his mentor comes in, and that sets up the rest of the play.
Well, because he's sort of ensnared by, in effect, he's taken on more than he can handle is what it sounds like.
It's that, and it's also what he wants to do in life. It's does he want to be just this guy who's handling divorce cases?
Mm-hmm.
Does he have greater ambitions? And will they work on the career path that he's chosen for himself?
So you kind of have the contrast between his vaunting ambition and the fact that he's not doing pretty terribly well in his day-to-day law practice.
The word feckless is a very good one to describe him, yes.
It's a word that could describe him to the very end of his days, don't you think?
I agree, which is part of the fun that I had writing this story.
Well, it also speaks to the whole idea of what, you know, what allows one to rise to power or celebrity, and that you can rise to power or celebrity with your flaws intact.
A lot of that has to do with, in my opinion, with publicity management, and that's becoming more and more of a danger. That when we strip away the gatekeepers of society, the so-called mainstream media that for many decades told us, okay, this is on the up and up, this is bogus, and so forth. When we get rid of those things, then we open ourselves up to assault from all kinds of different charlatans and charismatics.
Well, and I think it's fair to say that your subject was a bit of a pioneer in information image management, yeah?
Well, let's just say that it's a very good thing that this play is debuting on January 20th, which is also the inauguration of Donald Trump as president. Yes.
So you can kind of we're set up for a don't believe everything you hear, everything you read scenario, and in a way that it traces the arc of the contemporary distrust of the press.
Well, sure, but I mean, for much of its existence, the press was a distrustful organization. I mean, it's until very recent memory, you know, the 1960s, I want to say, late 60s, early 70s, it was basically just a publicity spin arm of whatever was in power, and it wasn't until the 1970s that it really took off as kind of an investigatory arbiter of the truth, if you will. The phrase speak truth to power, I mean, you know, I've been a journalist for 21 years now, and that's kind of what, you know, that's kind of what I've been pushing for. But I also know that, for the most part, that's not been the existence of the press.
No, I think that's quite fair to say, Anthony. Thanks very much for talking with us, and good luck with this show. Yeah, it's a timely opening this Friday.
Well, thank you very much. My it's a small town here, so my girlfriend is actually the director, Angie Thompson, and she's brilliant at this. So I'm pretty much convinced it's going to be okay.
Sounds great. Anthony Pignataro is the author of Small Town Lawyer, which will be performed at the Maui Fringe Festival at the Iao Theater in Wailuku from Friday to Sunday. Cast members are Kevin Hazelton, Vinnie Linares, Felicia Chernicki-Wolf, and the director is Angie Thompson. Bethann, at the top of the show, there was quite a few challenges to accepted wisdom.
By a neuroscientist, a researcher. And we're talking about Dr. Carl Hart, who spoke at on Friday at the Harm Reduction Conference in Honolulu, and some of the real challenges that he's having in trying to get people to understand that we can't just say drugs bad, drugs are doing these things to your brains, because he's saying that we don't really have enough research on that, and he's doing some of that research. And so watching how scientists talk to each other, and not yeah. with just a sense of, well, my science is better than your science, but as he said, the lovely thing about science is that the results should speak for themselves, as long as they're replicable and they're true.
And as long as we continue to live in a society that has some respect for science, and there's some concern about that.
Well, that's the bottom line, too. We'll talk more about that in coming weeks, no doubt, and months and
you
years.
Bet.
But for the moment, we're going to say goodbye to you and let you know that we will be back tomorrow morning. Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa will be here to sit down and talk about the current debate on the ACA and the future of Medicare and Medicaid under a Republican-controlled Congress.
And adapting to life in a Martian habitat with Hawaii as the model.
We always like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line anytime you like and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, that's our page, or tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
Past shows are archived under The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Join us tomorrow morning with more of The Conversation.